Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning and welcome to Speak Up. It is Monday, October 7th, 2024. My name is Magnus Stevens. I'm your host for today. And joining me in the studio today is...
It's Peter R.H.
And we have a good show for you. We're going to start off with an interview with Leslie McBain, who's one of the co-founders of advocacy group Mom Stop the Harm. And they are a group advocating on behalf of drug users and drug users' families and do a lot of work on advocating for drug policy. And we're going to talk about... the provincial election and some of the policies put forth by the various parties on the issue. And yeah, it's a really interesting conversation that'll be coming up in just a couple moments. Peter, what are you going to chat about today?
We're going to talk about 1936 film Things to Come. Now, the father of one of the co-architects of Simon Fraser University, Gerald Massey. Anyway, his father was after me, Raymond Massey. Mm-hmm. And this is a really odd film. It's about the future. It ends in 2036, so it still is. But I don't think it's going to wind up the way they say in the film. But I'll talk about it and bring up the book that it was based on, a 1933 H.G. Wells book. It's actually it's always credited that H.G. Wells wrote the screenplay for this film, but he wrote 3 years before the film came out a novel with the same title that ends in the year 2106.
Yeah,
and it has a few other changes to it.
Great. Sounds interesting. Sounds like we'll have a fun time with that one. We also have Gardening with Embark, and we're going to be talking about how you can get your indoor garden started now that we're heading into the fall, into the fall season, and you're winding up your outdoor gardening. So that'll be fun. And Stephen Fan may be here. I'm not 100% sure. But we're expecting him to drop by and talk a bit about what he's been checking out at the Vancouver International Film Festival. Today is October 7th. That makes it the one-year anniversary of the Hamas attacks on Israel that killed 1,200 Israelis and took another over 200 hostage and set in motion all the events of the past year that we have... witnessed in our TV news every evening. We've seen protests around the world against the Israeli assault into Gaza. And more recently, we have seen the expansion of the war with Hamas shooting rockets, or not Hamas, but Hezbollah shooting rockets from southern Israel into Israel. From southern Lebanon into Israel. Sorry about that. We've seen the Israelis respond first with airstrikes, now with a limited ground invasion, retaliatory attacks on Iran, and Iran launching a couple drone and missile attacks on Israel. And who knows where this is all going to end up, but what we do know is after a year of conflict, there are tens of thousands of people dead, and the death toll seems like it's only going to go on and on.
Well, hopefully something... I mean, they'll win in some way. With the state of it, Israel will win in some way because the other side really can't win. But, I mean, I think... I don't know if they are doing what is the minimal response?
Yeah,
I think that's what's demanded, and they could well be doing it. But I think the problem has come from a optics perspective. Is sort of at times a perceived gloating of like Israel or whatever it may be. I mean, it's been maybe they are doing the right procedure, but it hasn't looked good for them in some quarters.
No, I think I think definitely it has not looked good, especially with the high death toll from their actions.
Yes.
I mean, my feeling about it is that there really isn't a military solution to this overall situation.
I would go along with that myself.
And so, you know, pursuing some of the goals of destroying Hamas in Gaza and elsewhere, destroying Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, aren't really realistic. And pursuing them as aggressively as they have and in such an ongoing way still isn't going to achieve their stated aims. And we're going to end up with a lot of, and we have ended up with a lot of dead people. Hamas and Hezbollah themselves can't really claim to be victims, but there's a ton of civilians who have inevitably gotten in the way just by living their lives. And it doesn't seem that's going to change. You know, and unfortunately, there isn't a lot of interest on any of the sides towards a realistic negotiated solution. I mean, I think a solution probably exists, but I don't think the parties on either on any side are really wanting to make the compromises that would require. And part of the reason that happens is because, of course, because of all the conflict and all the killing and all the need for whether you want to call it vengeance or, you know, giving back what they got, it's the conditions aren't there for people to make the kind of compromises that might actually be needed to achieve peace. So we're left with war.
One quick thing I'll add. I think the rest of the Islamic world could be acting a bit better, taking the Palestinians in. Yeah. That's just a quick comment to say how I see the situation.
All right. Well, Stephen Fan is here, so we're going to be hearing from about VIF a little later in the program.
Absolutely. Is this thing on?
Yes, it is. You can tell when it's on when you wear your headphones.
Oh, wonderful.
Awesome secrets. Okay, well, yeah. Glad you're here, Steve. We're going to get on with our first segment. This is Leslie McBain, co-founder of Moms Stop the Harm, talking about the drug crisis and the provincial election and the policies that the various parties are putting forth.
We got dead air problems here.
No. It's not so much that as there's some other stuff here, so I'm having to do things in non-usual ways. But here we are. Sorry. Here is our interview with Leslie McBain. It really just wants to play that
good
one
morning,
segment.
And thank you for joining us here on the program. Joining me now is Leslie McBain, who's co-founder of Mom Stop the Harm. Perhaps you can introduce yourself and tell us a bit about Mom Stop the Harm.
Of course. My name is Leslie McBain. I, with two other women, co-founded Mom Stop the Harm back in about early part of 2016. We had all three of us lost our sons to drug harms, and we sort of serendipitously found each other and decided these deaths were not only tragic and heartbreaking and changed our lives, but they were also preventable. So we worked hard, and within a year we had really created Mom Stop the Harm with a website and with contacting different people that we knew and media as well. And today we're somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 members across across Canada. Our primary goal in creating the organization was to advocate for better drug policies that actually support and save the lives of people who use drugs. And we have branched out into, we now have support groups for two types of support groups, one for families who have lost a loved one to the drug harms, and another group of support groups for people who have a loved one still struggling. So we're busy, and we're in it for the long haul.
It really sounds like, you know, when you started up the group, that it really filled a hole that wasn't being filled by other groups.
Exactly. We were one of the first, well, certainly family-oriented, and we're the only one of the only family-oriented advocacy groups in the country. There's a couple more back east who we've certainly aligned with and have kept in communication with. But so here in the West, especially, well, Manitoba to BC, we are the loudest voice, let's just say.
Right. So we're heading into a provincial election. We're only 2 weeks away now. And the drug crisis and drug policy is taking a forefront in this campaign. What do you see as the most important issues regarding the opioid crisis and for the community in this election?
Well, I think the first priority, which should be just, you know, so visible to everyone, is to keep people alive, to keep people who use drugs, who do not have a safer supply, which is most of the drug users in this province, to keep them alive, to keep them safe from the horrendously toxic street market of the drugs that on which they are dependent. So that is number one priority. These are preventable deaths, as I've said, and the governments, all governments in the last, you know, 20 years have not attended to the fact that if people were able to access a safe, regulated, prescribed supply of the drugs that they need, they would stay alive. They wouldn't be dying. We wouldn't have the criminal justice system always involved. We wouldn't have tremendous ER visits. You know, there's the list goes on. It's the humane thing to do. So that's the top priority, I would say. Secondarily, our concern is both the Liberals and the Conservatives have discussed or talking about in their platform, secure or coerced care for people who are addicted, but also people with complex needs, such as mental health issues, as well as addiction. And we firmly are not in agreement with coerced care. So those two are primary for our advocacy. And we understand the problems around public safety and the concerns of the public there. But we think that these can be resolved in better ways than just locking people up.
So in the last year, we've seen a bit of a shift in sort of the policy direction that's been happening. It seems, you know, for a period of time before that, we seem to be moving forward into, you know, what seem to be helpful policies, whether it's safe injection sites and decriminalization. And some of that started to be rolled back. Part of what seems to go on is there's a lot of fear among the public about these policies. There's sort of, and there's a bit of a willingness to step forward, and then there's a stepping back. You know, we advanced on decriminalization, and that's been rolled back a bit. There's increasing opposition to safe injection sites, including the Conservatives. You know, their policies is to eliminate them. Mm-hmm. How do we combat that kind of fear? Because that seems to be one of the biggest stopping points from a political perspective of moving forward on a lot of policies that would be help solve the crisis.
Mm-hmm. As you suggest, it is fear-based. These are political manipulations. We've had safe consumption sites since Insight 20 years ago was opened, and thousands of lives have been saved. But what has happened is the rhetoric around them has shifted to something that isn't actually truthful. It's been called, I think, by John Rusted and by Pierre Poilievre, these have been called drug dens, which is, if it weren't so ugly, it would be funny. I mean, people who use drugs at safe consumption sites first of all, are safe. They don't die. And second of all, they're offered, given lots of references, lots of possibilities for recovery, for medical attention, and so on. They're absolutely necessary, yet they've been characterized in a way that is, again, fear-based, and that people just think this is, that we're, I guess some old-fashioned word, mollycoddling people who use drugs. It's just not the case.
So one of the big policy moves recently has been around involuntary treatment. What is the reasons you are opposed to it? Because, you know, from, I think, what many people would see is that lots of folks out there don't seem to be in a position to make good choices for themselves through their addiction or circumstances or mental health, and maybe there needs to be some intervention. So why do you feel it's not a good policy?
Well, first of all, it's quite unclear exactly what either of the parties that are advocating for this kind of program. It's not clear what they mean. The devil's in the details in this. Mm-hmm. Coerced care, involuntary care for people who are addicted, let's just stick with that for the moment, has never proved to have great success. And that's not just here, but that is globally. Countries where coerced care has been implemented see that after a person comes out of that recovery type of facility are very vulnerable. The reasons for their drug use in the first place have not been attended to properly or on a long-term basis. And they come out and they generally, people want to go back to their old ways because they're not, well, certainly in the case of BC, if people do go into involuntary care and they come out drug-free, do they have a job? Do they have housing? Do they have support? Do they have ongoing treatment with counseling, for instance? No, they don't. And that's even with voluntary care. With involuntary care, people often, especially youth, I would have to add, come out mistrusting a system that would throw them into a locked facility and try and make them better without their consent. It just breeds mistrust in an already shaky system. So we're really against, and if I could just go on a little bit about that, what it seems like what both these parties' platforms have done is ignore the first part of the spectrum of this, wherein people would have a safer prescribed supply so they can stabilize, could get into an evidence-based treatment facility, would have those ongoing supports. That isn't present in it's only a tiny percentage of people who can access that. But these two parties have gone right to the other end of the spectrum saying, well, let's just lock them up. That is not the way for success, nor is it humane, nor is it going to keep anybody safe. They can't keep people forever. And I will grant you, of course, and I agree with this, people who, as we already know from the Mental Health Act, are a danger to themselves and others, can be incarcerated. I say incarcerated, can be put into secure care one way or the other. We need to stay safe. Neighborhoods have to be safe. But I think if these other things were in place, neighborhoods would be safer. So it's just the platform is just a sort of a easy and manipulative way to let the public think things will be better and people will be safer.
So what are the policies you'd like to see supported by the parties and put into action mm-hmm. here?
Yeah, the Green Party actually has, we're almost 100% on the same page as the Green Party. First of all, increasing and broadening and strengthening the programs for a regulated pharmaceutical supply of drugs for people who are addicted or dependent. That's the first step. Rather than pulling it back, rather than dispensing with this whole thing, actually making it better, making it more accessible, low barrier to people, keep them safe, keep them alive. The building out of different types of government, not private, but government facilities for recovery. And that means evidence-based. That means meeting the person's individual's needs and providing the supports that are necessary for them to stabilize and have full lives. And it's a tall order, but what I always say is it's not impossible. And if it's not impossible, it is possible with the right priorities, with the right funding, with the right professionalism. That is the answer. That is not what we're seeing here. We're seeing fear, sort of fear trumping evidence. We need the evidence-based ways to go forward to keep people alive and recovered.
The Conservative Party and John Rusted are promising to shut down safe injection sites if they come to power. What will the fallout be of such a policy?
Yeah, the fallout will be death. There's just no two ways about it. Safe consumption sites keep people from dying from the toxic supply. The toxic supply, of course, comes from organized crime. They're just forging ahead and making huge amounts of money and huge amounts of product that are toxic and often lethal. So if people who are dependent and who need, and people have to understand, the public has to understand addiction too. That's something I have to throw in there. So people go into safe consumption site, they are generally safe for those moments, and they go on in their lives, whatever those lives look like. Without safe consumption sites, people, again, and this is, you know, it's so ironic because then the people who are unhoused, the most vulnerable of us, are forced to use in public or outdoors. And since decriminalization has been rolled back, so where people are not allowed to be in X, Y, and Z spaces, they're very, very vulnerable to not only to overdose and death, but to arrest. So closing safe consumption sites is absolutely going backwards. It is inhumane, and it shows very clearly that the people who are creating the rhetoric around this don't care very much about the human beings who are dependent on drugs.
Not that we want to make up drug policy on the fly, but it seems like, decriminalization and safe injection sites are something that would work together, and that, you know, some of the challenges of decriminalization, such as, you know, people using in places that really make the public really uncomfortable, might be mitigated by a greater availability of safe injection sites.
Absolutely. If safe consumption sites the number of them was expanded, then yes, people have a place to go. As it is, as it stands right now, as we were just talking about, for people who are unhoused, they have no other place but to be out of doors. And this, the public doesn't like to see this. Safe consumption sites, as I said before, not only provide a safe space, the attention a person needs if they have a very bad batch of drugs in their possession, but they're also helped in many different ways, supported in different ways. I think the expansion of the role, the funding, first of all, and the role of safe consumption sites is one of the answers to this problem. I would love to see if safe consumption sites could be merged with safer supply programs. And, you know, I know there's always the geographic problems where people don't want to see these things in their neighborhoods. It is a challenge to find spaces where everybody feels safe. But again, if it's not impossible, then it is possible. It's just the matter of whatever government becomes in power. The Ministry of Mental Health and Addictions has to spend time and resources on not applying Band-Aids, but actually getting to the bottom of the problem which is support and attention and, well, housing, obviously, and the whole spectrum of needs that people have who are dealing with this disorder. Right now, the road to recovery that is offered through St. Paul's Hospital in Vancouver is one of the most brilliant programs around. It should be expanded throughout the province, throughout the country, and it helps people go from one stage to the next, to the next. So it's the information and the evidence is there. It's clear, but people don't like to think about supporting, you know, their tax dollars or whatever going to helping people who are in this situation. I just say, learn what you can about addiction, about the challenges, about trauma, about mental health issues that need to be addressed. I wish the public would start to understand so they could be a little more empathetic and support some of these programs.
Are you able to rate the party's platforms with respect to the drug crisis, what they're proposing?
Well, I'd certainly say the Greens have it almost 100%. And between, you know, if I were to have a magic wand, I would obviously have the Greens in power. I think they're a lot of their platform is good in many other ways than just drug policy. Yeah. But the NDP, at least we've been working with the NDP for the last few years, and we have made some progress. So, you know, I'm not going to be specific here because I do see Premier Eby rolling back, you know, taking a little bit more of a right-wing stance on this and wanting to have involuntary care and seeing what has been proposed and what is actually, I think, legislation now on the decriminalization. Seeing him trying to step back on that it's really demoralizing in terms of, and anyway, I think we could still work. We, being the advocates who advocate for people to use drugs, yeah, could still work with the NDP. Seems like the conservatives across the country and really even across North America don't understand, don't look at the evidence, only look at what is politically advantageous to them. You know, it's almost like to heck with people who use drugs. We don't care about them. We don't want to see them. We don't care if they recover or not. Let's just make them invisible. That seems to be what the conservatives are going with, you know, that everything is broken. We can't fix it. So let's just get them off the streets, lock them up, lock them up either in this involuntary treatment or stick with the criminal justice system, that pillar of enforcement. So it's it's difficult to see, and I don't know what will happen in the next, you know, in this next year.
We have a bit of time left before the election. Mm-hmm. What questions should listeners, people listening now, and voters be asking their candidates at events about this issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the questions that I asked when I went to a town hall meeting with our local candidate for MLA is I asked him what will the Conservative Party do if they get in power to mitigate the 6 to 7 deaths every day in this province? What will be the what's the plan? And he did not have an answer for me. Sorry, my parrot is in the background. And he couldn't answer me. And he said, well, I've answered that in my health plan. And I said, no, you didn't. And he actually just ignored me and went on to the next question. So I think that there's not an answer. They don't have an answer to the question of what to do today. They have all this sort of aspirational rhetoric around expanding treatment. And there's never been enough treatment facilities, and so there people should be asking the candidates what are you going to do, and then people should be asking themselves, is this reasonable, is this empathetic, is this humane, is this doable? And the answer will be no, in terms of certainly the Conservatives and maybe the NDP as well. People should really look at the Green Party platform on this. And even if they don't vote Green, they will learn a lot about what is reasonable and what will actually have a chance of you know, ameliorating the situation.
You know, looking forward beyond the election, and obviously a lot depends on you know, the outcome of the election, who gets in power. Mm-hmm. But where do we see this issue going over the next 5 or 10 years? You know, we've certainly made a lot of progress over the last 20 years. Do you feel that's going to continue despite some of the setbacks we've talked about?
Yes, I think it will. And the reason I think that is because people who are advocating for better drug policies are not going to quit. We may be slowed down a bit, by, depending on who comes to power, which party comes to power. But it's not like we're going to stop advocating. And we hope that with further, well, the whole thing of education too, education in the schools, in the high schools, in university courses, through media, that people will begin to understand that there is a way to make this problem less of a problem and to help people who are in need. So we will make progress. I always say it's a bit like turning the Titanic. You know, it's going to be very, very slow. If parties on the right get in and do not support don't support our ideas, but we'll keep going. And in 5 or 10 years, what I would hope to see is a greatly expanded pharmaceutical regulated supply of drugs for people who need it, and evidence based treatment, voluntary treatment, and enough of it. So we'll just keep moving in that direction. It takes years. I mean, it took, 40 years for cannabis to be legalized. So we're in it for the long haul.
Great. What's one thing you would say to people when thinking about this issue to help them sort of cut through all the chatter and all the back and forth?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, to educate themselves, to look at the evidence, it's a busy society we live in. It's hard to do deep dives into research and into, into what's really going on. The BC Center on Substance Use, for whom I am engaged, with whom I'm engaged as the family committee lead, has a tremendous amount of great research on their website, which is bccsu.com. And I would encourage people to learn more about addiction, what causes addiction, what it feels like, what it is, how it can be treated. People just don't know the details. And I don't, I don't fault people or judge people for not knowing, but we should all be in the mode of learning and finding out what it really is and why it's a problem. And that way, then we can see our way to a reasonable path to solutions.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today, Leslie McBain of Mom Stop the Harm. How do people find out more about what Mom Stop the Harm does?
Mm-hmm. We have a website, and it is www.momstoptheharm.com. It's updated regularly. Anyone who has been faced with any issues around drug harms and who are struggling are absolutely welcome. And there's a lot of learning to be had at that website as well. I encourage people to visit those websites.
Great. Thank you so much, Leslie McBain, co-founder of Mom Stop the Harm. It's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you so much.
And that was, of course, Leslie McBain, co-founder of Mom Stop the Harm. That interview happened on Friday. The provincial election is coming up really soon. This is one of the most important issues that's in front of us, and I'd really encourage you to really, as Leslie says, educate yourself as much as possible about these issues, because there's a lot of simple talk that goes on and simple solutions offered that may sound good but aren't going to achieve the impacts that we need. We're going to jump into Gardening with Embark, and then we'll be back in about 10 minutes with Stephen Fan and the Vancouver International Film Festival. Welcome to Gardening with Embark. And joining me here in the studio, as you know, every week, is Pablo Vimas of Embark's Sustainability Society and Embark's Gardens Manager.
Nice to be here.
Yeah. And you are running Embark's Community and Learning Gardens.
Correct, yes. So we have in campus two learning gardens. And yeah, so besides those gardens are being offering a space for SFU faculty, staff, and students, as well, we use the space for teaching gardening skills.
And I would really encourage anyone interested in learning more about gardening, well, obviously listen to our little weekly segment here. You can learn a lot. But if you want a more intensive education in running your own garden, you should check out with Pablo and the learning programs that Embark runs on a regular basis.
Yes. So as a gardening education topics, we have three seasons. So one we have in the spring, usually we start from April to mid-May, and then we go summer mid-May to mid-August. That is the largest period of gardening. And then we go in the fall, starting at the end of September till the end of October.
Yep. A great opportunity to learn and take away skills that you can put to use in your own garden. We're getting towards the end of the growing season.
Correct, yeah.
And we here at Gardening Embark will be taking a break soon, because it's just going to soon be, well, the gardening takes a break, and so there's less to talk about and teach you about, but we will be picking up everything again when the gardening season starts ramping up in the new year. Mm-hmm. But it also means perhaps a shift from indoors to outdoors to indoors.
Correct. So, yes, we are in week 40, and it's forecasted first frost by week 45. I checked the forecast. It's November the 7th.
Yep.
That's when we are going to have the first frost. So, yeah, the garden is slowly is going into bed. The plants will start growing, stop growing as fast as usual. So, yeah, we are going to, it's the time to start thinking in moving the garden from outdoors to indoors.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what I have come today, while I was walking through campus, I saw lots of shaggy maned mushrooms.
Yeah.
And I realized, like, well, why we don't grow mushrooms indoors?
Mm-hmm.
We have all those mushroom kits that you can get in the supermarkets and start growing. The light from those mushrooms don't need direct sunlight. They need a soft light. And at the moment, we have this nice soft light from the window, so we can grow mushrooms. And the other is we can start our microgreen gardens indoors. Okay. So so it means that we need to use our grow lights, which we can grow microgreens the whole winter. Microgreens are harvested 15 days after you plant it.
Oh, wow.
So it's a constantly harvesting and having fresh vegetables for,
right. So what are the microgreens? What are those? What are those
microgreens
plants?
Small plants, so the seed germinates and we eat the plants after 15 days.
Right.
So they are very small. What is good for microgreens is that all the nutrients that are stored in the seed are transformed and in a way that our body can assimilate those nutrients very quick.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. So rather than eating the seeds, we germinate them and we eat the tiny plants.
Right.
And both of them contain the same amount of nutrients. Right.
So is this kind of like shoots and stuff and
yes.
Small leafy greens? And
yeah, shoots will be a different. Shoots grows, we grow them in water.
Yeah.
And then we have to wash at least 3 times a day. So it's quite a bit of demand in growing sprouts that we call.
Yeah.
So I prefer growing microgreens because we can put a thin layer of soil and on those we spread the seeds. And from them, we have the tiny little plants.
Yeah.
Yeah. So sprouts is a bit more. You need to be on top. You need to wash frequently because humidity and temperature, indoor temperature, our house, good environment for bacteria.
Right.
And if we forget once, you will have to throw all the batch. So it's like, no, I prefer the using a bit of soil. Yeah.
So what would be some of the names of the microgreens that someone would be looking for?
So we can,
when they're buying seeds.
We can grow broccoli, mustard, lettuce. We can kale, sunflowers, chia seeds.
Yeah,
fenugreek. That's some of the more popular microgreens that we can grow. And yeah, you can buy microgreen seeds in the garden centers.
Yeah.
In bulk. Which are a very cheap price. And yeah, so we just kind of start growing your microgreens. You will need light, though.
Yeah.
Grow lights.
But those are, you know, I've seen those on online. And they're quite affordable nowadays. The grow lights are LED and stuff. And
yeah, so that is another thing. If you go to a garden center, you might be paying quite a bit. What I do, I go to the centers that are targeted to hydroponics, because hydroponics is an indoor way of growing vegetables, and they have grow lights, an affordable price. Yeah. So yeah, so visit any hydroponic shop that offers those and grab your grow lights from there.
And how much space would you typically? I mean, obviously this depends on each person, but I mean, what might be a typical sort of amount of space?
Amount of space, let's say you can start with a 1 foot, a square foot in the countertop of your kitchen with a tiny little light hanging from this light, or you can go a bit bigger, 2 square feet, and that's the start. Just as well, remember, we'll be harvesting each week if you are constantly seeding and harvesting. Yeah. So it depends how much you would like to grow. So I start with a small saucer, coffee saucer. This is small as well, until you develop the taste for those microgreens.
Yeah.
So try different seeds, different plants, until you find that these are the ones that I really like, and you can keep growing those.
Great. So just before we finish up, quickly just describe what the setup is, because you mentioned it's a very thin layer of soil. So what does it kind of look like?
So you will find that container. For instance, the containers I use is the ones that the cherry tomatoes come into.
Yeah.
Yeah, these little clamshells.
Yeah.
So in that clamshell, I put 1 finger thick of soil, of potting soil.
Yeah.
Compacted nicely, making a nice bed for the seeds, and then you sprinkle all my seeds, let's say our kale seeds, all uniformly spread.
Yeah.
And
those are just spread on top.
On top of the soil. And then using a small piece of wood, I compress those seeds into the soil.
Yeah.
And that clamshell sits on another tray on which I add water. So I don't add water directly on the seeds, but in another tray where the water will go under.
Right. And so typically those tomato clamshells will have little holes around the outside.
Yes, they are already. So the water gel will seep into the soil, and you just need to keep moist. No wet, just moist. So every 2 days you will check, add some water, and then you can even close the clamshell and put that under the grow light. So the grow lights have to be up on for at least 12 hours.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, it actually sounds relatively easy. Is there any particular trick that people need to watch out for?
No overwatering.
Yeah.
And if you see that there are some little hairs, white hairs, mold, sometimes we think it's mold, but sometimes as well they are just the roots of the seedlings. So just be keep an eye on that. If it's mold and you feel like, or you see that and you feel like, oh, it's mold, it's just take the whole batch and throw it away and you start a new one. Yeah.
But you're doing that all the time, so it's not a big loss.
Not a big loss, yes, because once you throw, you start all over again, and after 3 times, you become proficient in that.
That's great. Well, it sounds really fascinating, and it sounds like a great winter project to keep your fresh greens coming.
Yes, yes. So some very nutritious greens that you can add in your sandwich, in your salads, and anything that, you would like to have some greens.
And you mentioned how these particular kinds of greens are really well absorbed by the body, too. So they're really quite nutritious.
Yes, very well nutritious, indeed.
Excellent. That sounds great. Thanks so much for telling us about that, Pablo.
You're welcome. I'm happy to share those experiences.
Pablo Vimes of Embark Sustainability Society. Pablo's here every week talking about gardening. And tell us how to find out more about Embark Sustainability.
Yeah, Embark Sustainability is a non-profit organization that we are basing in SFU campus in Burnaby. Yep. You can look out for us at embarksustainability.org or for our social channels at hashtag Embark Sustain.
Great. Thanks so much, Pablo. Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Bye-bye. And Gardening Embark is with us here every week on Monday Speak Up. We're getting to the end of the season, though, as the growing season is coming to an end, too. But we have a few more weeks. Now, though, we're going to turn our attention to the Vancouver International Film Festival. And Stephen Fan has been getting out and taking in some out and about. Exactly. What have you been seeing?
Yeah, I've seen a whole ton of stuff. So the film festival ran all the way from September 26th until October 6th. It just ended, yeah. Obviously, earlier. And I saw a whole bunch of movies. It started with the opening gala, which is around Ari's theme. Mm-hmm. And Ari's theme was this wonderful documentary about a composer in Victoria who happens to be quadriplegic. Or it's not quadriplegic, but he had a muscle degeneration disease that caused him to not have control over a lot of his body. And the film is not just an expression of his struggles and travails, but also kind of a philosophical questioning of what does it mean to be a composer and what does it mean to be human? Because here's a guy who has control over his mind, completely clear mind, incredibly intelligent and talented person, but who has some difficulty, who needs help with many other bodily functions. And he still carved out a successful career as a musical composer. Yeah. And the movie, the documentary, goes all the way back to the beginning of his life and traces his growing up, and it also shows lighter moments, like him playing, on the Sega machine when he was a kid. Mm-hmm. He really enjoyed video games, and so it was kind of a really reflective discussion and review of what it means to have a life, both as a human being and as an artist. So that was wonderful. I went to the opening gala for that and saw the movie and participated in the Q&A after. And then,
what was that film called?
It's called Ari's Theme.
And it
premiered in Vancouver. And the next one I saw at different times because complicated reasons, but I saw it different times, and I saw another movie called House of the Seasons. Mm-hmm. And House of the Seasons is this wonderful Korean movie, and it's not like a typical Korean movie, because typical Korean movies, there's a lot of urban drama, there's kind of very cool cutting-edge stuff, but this is kind of it goes back to an ancestral village, essentially, of a family that has made tofu for several generations. And it's not really about tofu. The tofu is just a backdrop. It's set in a village in Daegu Island, which is a very symbolic part of Korea. Mm-hmm. And it kind of just goes over the family dynamics. And I was thinking about this last night. How would I describe it? And honestly, I thought the best way to describe it is Korean Buddenbrooks. And it's just kind of it's a discussion of the travails of a family over several generations, mm-hmm. how it, comes together and splits apart and comes together again. And the reason it's called the House of the Seasons is it actually follows the family through most of 1 year, going through the seasons. And it starts out on July 20th, the movie, the hypothetical time in the movie, and it starts out in the midsummer, and it was when they're supposed to conduct the ancestral rites, and it goes all the way until the deep winter. And it's just the main thing I would say about that movie is that the cinematography is just superb. It just reminded me of Akira Kurosawa. Like, there are just so many shots, lingering shots, where you look at the shots, and it was just so enigmatic. And you know, sort of incredible at the same time. So that's one thing. But also before I kind of I watched the movies, I also had done a number of interviews. I'm just going to quickly go through the movies. The other movie I kind of just finished writing a review on is The Chef and the Daruma. And The Chef and the Daruma, you know, takes us all the way back across the Pacific. It's about a chef in Vancouver. The chef it is about is a guy named Tojo. And he is the owner of Tojo's on West Broadway, a very famous restaurant in Vancouver. And the story, you know, it is, in theory, the story is really about the invention of the California roll, because Chef Tojo is usually credited as one of the inventors of the California roll. And just to tell the story quite simply, what happens was that Chef Tojo got to Vancouver in 1971, eventually started experimenting with different styles, trying to appeal to local audiences. Actually, you know, when he initially started, he worked for a restaurant on the downtown east side in the former Japantown called Maneki. And it was like the fourth or fifth Japanese restaurant to open up in the city. And at the time, they had basically like 100% Japanese clientele. Mm-hmm. It was just people who had immigrated from Japan and wanted a taste of home. And eventually, Chef Tojo thought, look, I really want to expand the clientele, expand the audience. And he pushed it out. And he was trying to basically get things to appeal to local audiences. And people were telling him that, you know, North Americans didn't like seeing seaweed in their sushi. And this is something that turned them off. Yeah. So he was like, don't worry about it. I'll put the seaweed inside the sushi roll. So he invented what he called the inside-out roll, which is now the California roll.
Right.
And then, you know, people told him, you know, they didn't like raw fish. So it's no worries. So he did this thing where he mixed cooked crab with mayo, you know, absolutely traditional North American ingredient, and put it inside the sushi roll with the seaweed inside. That is actually the California roll.
Right.
And that's what all of us eat like every week now. You know, there are other inventors for this sushi roll, but I think he's probably one of the main ones, probably the leading one. And certainly the story is told with absolute verve. And it goes back to his upbringing as a kid in a very large family in rural Japan. I think it was in Kagamoshi, whatever, prefecture, and, you know, him training in Osaka. It's a wonderful story, and they actually had to do a third screening. They only originally planned for two screenings. That is, putting a third screening was so popular, and people were lining up for it. And
people really love a local story, too.
It's a great local story, and the story is told really well. So I thought, and I'm sure it's going to come back at some future point, you know, to be in some other theaters, whatever. So I'm sure they'll find it useful. And I also, one more movie, which is kind of very short one, or a couple more movies, very short one is called Sauna Days. And Sauna Days is kind of a movie, a very short movie, about 16 minutes, 17 minutes from, it's one of the short series, it's from the Baltic. And it's about basically a group of men who work heavy labor jobs, going to the sauna after a long day. And it's very atmospheric. It just focuses on them enjoying the sauna, the moments after their work, and it's not there's no real huge plot here. It's very suggestive, but there's not meant to be a plot driven story. It just kind of gets you into the sauna almost, and that's wonderful. And this reminds me, actually, I chatted with Casey Wei. Casey Wei is the director of shorts, so the short films for VIFF, and I kind of chatted to her about this, and I was like, you know, people always say different things about shorts. Some shorts turn out great. You know, like there was a short from several years ago about Filipino-Canadian migrant families called Ime, and that's became actually a feature-length film this time. But how do you process shorts? And she's like, look, you know, when you watch a short film, at least at VIFF, is they organize them into series. So the series, you know, would have a number of short movies. Like, you would sit there for a couple of hours, and then it would be a bunch of shorts. But they're not organized by theme. It's not like sauna, and so the next one's swimming. It's not right. You know, it's not like that.
So you're gonna get a variety of.
You're getting a variety of things, but I was like, but then it's chaos, right? She's like, no, it's not chaos. She's like, it's organized kind of really by vibe. Because she organized, basically you have to trust the curator to do the work. So if you like Sauna Days, for example, which is in short series one, she was like, you probably like all of the other ones because it should have very kind of compatible vibes. It might not be about underwater things, but it will be other things which have produce a similar feeling, kind of a comparable feeling. And I really like that. And then you kind of just got to trust the curator to do the work. That was really cool. And I also spoke with Curtis Wilichuk, who is a director of programming overall for the VIF. And one thing I kind of asked him is, what were they looking for in this year's VIF? And this is something we kind of talked about with both Casey Way and Curtis Wilichuk. And I think Curtis gave a really interesting answer. And Curtis was like, listen, like, at the end of the day, you know, this is kind of a, we have a big focus on indie film. And one of the biggest things about indie film is you want to help auteurs, you want to help filmmakers grow their own voice. The single most important thing they're looking for, and this applies to anyone who's potentially looking to submit a film or get involved in this, is for people to develop and to have their own voice, to have their own aesthetic, because that's the most important thing going forward. You know, stories can change and plot lines can change, but the most distinctive thing about an auteur, about a filmmaker, is going to be their own voice.
Yeah.
And this reminds me, actually, of the interview I did, so I'm just linking everything up now, with a lady called, a filmmaker based in Vancouver, I think she's actually based in SFU, called Kang Yuqi. She's originally from Inner Mongolia, from China. She's Mongolian Chinese. But she has done a variety of films kind of exploring existential and religious and metaphysical themes. And so her newest film is called 7 Beats Per Minute. Yep. And this is not something where it's not like one of her previous films where she goes to Tibet or she follows a sheep herder or whatever. 7 Beats Per Minute is actually a documentary about a Chinese freediver. So it's about a woman named Jessia Liu, who is actually the first Chinese champion female freediver. And it's about her struggles, her accidents. In one of her previous feats, you know, she ended up underwater for 4 minutes, and that was quite dangerous, quite challenging. And it's not just about these moments. And
right. And free diving, that's about where they basically hold, take a breath, and yeah, then descend as deeply as possible.
Absolutely.
And we're talking like a long way, like 100 feet plus. I don't know the details, but
I think this one's a lot more than 100 feet, because yeah, one time she did a free dive in 2018. Jessia's life was nearly cut short when she blacked out 20 meters underwater during her last world record attempt, a dive of 93 meters, and she was lifeless for 4 minutes. And I think she actually had an accident that kind of was permanent. And I think she's in Hawaii now, and she's finished a PhD, yeah, and has a really great job. But I think the film kind of also reflects on the way that these things don't necessarily, yeah, make up for the tragedies and accidents in life and kind of the internal doubts you still have. The filmmaker, Yu Qikang, she formed a really tight relationship with the subject. Okay. And we kind of had a discussion about the ethics of this as well.
So we're almost out of time. Any last films we got?
I'm just going to quickly go through
it. We got to give a minute to...
Yeah, I also saw The Gift, which is a film, kind of a Japanese environmental film that was super atmospheric. It's made by the fact that it was at the Rio Theater, which is beautiful. And it's by Ryosuke. And I think that's really mostly it. I think one more. And there's a sort of super local film called Prelude to History, and it was only an hour long. It's about basically a local artistic couple who goes to Pender Island to try and recuperate and recover their relationship.
Yep.
And it's left open whether that works or not. And it was very atmospheric. I loved it as well.
So the festival's over now. Do we know where they might be available for folks who want to see them?
I think the best thing to do is just go on the VIF website. And there's a bunch of trailers and descriptions. And I think if you search elsewhere with the name, and sometimes it will come up.
Yeah.
I've watched it in a variety of places. But for example, the Yuqi Kang film, the 7 beats per minute free dive film, that's coming out this winter with a theatrical release by the National Film Board of Canada. So that would be really interesting, and that'd be really cool.
Great. Thanks, Stephen. That's so good. And I expect in this day and age, people can search and find some of this stuff on streaming, if not now, eventually. Yeah. Peter, we've run out of time for your segment.
We'll have it next week.
We will have it next week.
Shape of Things to Come.
So that's a seminal and very early science fiction.
The German film Metropolis, which is a silent film, is 1926.
It's 1936. Okay, we're 26. Out of time. We'll be with that next week. Thanks. Stay tuned for Democracy Now.